And we are at the St. Francis Convent in Hankinson, North Dakota. I am Joyce Reinhardt Larson, a volunteer interviewer from the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU Library. And at this time, I am interviewing Sister Jean Louise. And I will begin by asking her her name and her date of birth, and where was she born?
I'm Sister Jean Louise Schaefer. I was baptized Nancy Jean Schaefer. I was born in Elgin, in the hospital in Elgin, in Grant County, North Dakota. Grew up on the farm in Flasher. I was born on May 18, 1955. So that puts me in another generation than you are used to interviewing, but I'm happy to share with you about my family.
Well, that'll be interesting. What is your father and mother's name?
My father is Adam M. for Michael Schaefer, and my mother is Helen Elizabeth Engelman Schaefer.
Do you know where they came from, or their ancestors came from in South Russia?
My father's family came from the colony of Speyer in South Russia. He told us Landowski County. And they came over in 1908, but that's another story. My mother was a German-Hungarian who came to and settled in New England, North Dakota.
That's interesting, yeah. That is interesting. So your grandparents on your father's side were German-Russian then?
Yes.
Did you get to know them? Or
my grandparents, oh yes.
They're still living, probably.
No, my grandparents, I knew all through my childhood, but Grandma died in 1973, and Grandpa Schaefer died in 1989. Mm-hmm. So I knew them quite well, especially Grandpa.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You sure did. So you grew up in Elgin, North Dakota?
I grew up at Flasher, born in Elgin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I'm the fourth oldest of 11 children.
Really?
The first two died in infancy, so we counted ourselves as nine usually. So I'm actually the second oldest of nine living.
What made you decide to join the convent?
Well, I have influence of religious sisters in my grade school. They taught me, Benedictine sisters from Bismarck, taught in the Catholic grade school in Flasher that I attended through the fourth grade. And I have an aunt, my father's sister would be Sister Charlene Schaefer, is a sister in Techne, Illinois. And my grandfather, Michael Schaefer, had two sisters who were Benedictine sisters at Richardson at Sacred Heart Monastery. So we knew sisters were a big part of our life, and prayer and the church was a big part of our life. So it wasn't any real surprise for me to have that desire to follow whatever the Lord wanted me to do. And once I knew it was be a sister, well then that was simply what I was going to do.
At what age was that when you knew for sure?
Well, I knew for sure. I would say when I was in high school, I knew for sure. Now, I didn't want it in high school. I didn't really think that that's what I wanted to do, but I knew that that's what God was calling me to do. When I remember when I was in high school that we would be praying in church, and I would say, Lord, I remember this one specific time saying, Lord, I want to love you better, and I want you to show me how. And then when I was a senior, an assignment in a composition class was write a paragraph, what you're going to be doing in 5 years from now. And I wrote, I'm going to be a sister. I didn't know where, how it was going to work out, but I just knew that that's what I was going to be. So
you know you're in the right place.
Yes.
That's neat. Not a lot of people do.
No. Then when I went on to college, I went to a public college at Dickinson State. Mm-hmm. Was very involved in the church, but and visited communities, but didn't really make a decision until I met the sisters here, when I was already working.
Doing what?
As a professional high school librarian up at Lakota, North Dakota.
Oh,
I was there for 2 years, and then the Lord got me.
Uh-huh. Through influence of the sisters here in Hankinson.
Yes. the sister who is the mother superior, the provincial superior here right now, was at that time the youth director for the Diocese of Fargo. And she was in charge of what a youth program for 16, youth 16 to about 25, called the Search Program. And it was a program of peer ministry on a weekend that involved about 80 to 100 kids about 7 weekends a year. And I was working on the team, often worked on the team, helping to put on that retreat for new upcoming students. And there I met her because she was, I was involved with that out in the Bismarck Diocese when I was in college, high school and college. Then when I moved to this part of the state, I got involved up here with it. And she met her, and I, the first, almost the first time I met her, about the second time I met her, I said to her, I'm interested in your community. And she said, great, come down and visit. At that time, I did not know that there was a Hankins in North Dakota. I didn't know that there were Franciscan sisters in North Dakota because I had that influence of the Benedictines out in the Bismarck Diocese. Yeah. But then she invited me to come and visit, and it was about, oh, maybe 5 or 6 months later that I got up the courage to come. And then after that first visit, about 2 months later, I made a commitment to enter. So it was a couple, some months before I did actually enter, but then I knew that this was where I belonged.
And when was that?
That was in 1979-80. So I entered here in June 7th of 1980.
Mm-hmm. And when you came here then, what was it, hard to get back to see family? Were you restricted to stay here for a certain time?
I'll tell you about the steps in religious life, and that will help you a little bit to understand about the family visits. The first step is anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, and it's called the postulancy. And that means, really, it comes from the Latin word meaning to ask. I ask the community if they will look at me and see if I can live here. Mm-hmm. They look at me, and then I look at the community and say, can I live here? And so during that 6 months time, I did not go home, but my family could come to visit me. Now my family lives 300 miles away, so they didn't come often, but they probably came once that summer. Then we have a 2-year period called the novitiate, which is a more intense period of prayer and study, where we, in fact, do not go out and rarely leave the city of Hankinson. So that's a more cloistered time, part of the initial formation. But it's necessary so that one can really concentrate on the task at hand and not have other distractions. During that time, we were not allowed to go home. Before I entered that novitiate period, I had a 2-week vacation at home, and that was in the December of 1980, around Christmas time there. And then I entered the novitiate on January 1st of 1981. So. Or January 2nd, I guess it was, in 1981. Mm-hmm. And then that 2-year period of the novitiate, the first year is spent here at the Mother House. The second year is called an apostolic year, where we go out more to work in our apostolates or our missions. For example, schools or nursing homes or hospitals that are run by our sisters. And we begin to work more integrating religious life, the prayer life, along with work life and community life, all very much a part of our way of life. And I worked at St. John's School in Wahpeton as a professional librarian that year, during that apostolic year. And then at the end of those 2 years, that would take us to January of 83, I made my first vows. And that was, we make our first vows for 3 years and then renew them ordinarily for 2 years. So it's about a 5-year period of temporary vows before we make our final commitment. Now again, during those time of temporary vows, our family may come to visit us, and I went home every summer to visit for 2 weeks. So that's about what it amounted to. However, if I happened to be in the area for work, and at that time I had a brother in Fargo, and so I could go and visit my brother, you know, for
half a day or stop in to see them too. So that wasn't, weren't restrictions on that, you know, as long as it was feasible.
What did your family, how did they look at that when you made this commitment?
To join
the convent, yeah.
They were happy, at least my parents, I should say, were very happy about it, but they were very cautious. They did not express that to me very much. So I didn't know whether they were pleased, whether that was something that they thought I should do, knew I would do. I just really didn't know their reaction, although they were very supportive of me in terms of praying and, you know, just keep on, you know, keep on doing what you're doing, but not something big and grandiose, which is very common, I think, you know, in our family. And not until I made my final vows did they really make some expressions to me of commitment, you know, or applauding my commitment. And that was, I'm sure, because they said, well, we don't want to pressure her, you know. It's her life. She has to make her own decisions. But I know interiorly they were very happy. My brothers and sisters found it a little bit more difficult. Since I'm the second oldest, some of them were at home when I had already left for college and working. And so I didn't know them quite as well, particularly my youngest sister. And she, since I didn't know her very well, we didn't communicate too much. But she only told me later on that it took her a long time to get over anger because I pulled left the family, you know, and made this decision not to come home all the time. Now, of course, she's very happy. They're all very supportive of me, very happy for me. But they all had to work through their own initial reaction to it. I think it was easier in a way in our family because I also have a brother who's a priest. And so they followed him through all of those steps of his preparation for the priesthood too. And they realized that, hey, this is something very important in our family. And so they were then very supportive. And now they're very supportive, although I don't see them very often, but I talk on the phone.
And your brother's younger than you?
Yes, he's 3 years younger than I am. He's a priest at Mont. Mm-hmm.
So your influence really for this religious way of life came from, well, your family. I mean, you all,
yes,
were always involved in church.
Right, right. From the family and from teachers, I would say, those early teachers in school. Very strong community, parish community on campus at the college. And this search program that I mentioned before was a very strong influence in keeping my faith alive and spurring my faith development that led me to pursue whatever the Lord was calling me to. So,
what are some of the distinctive religious customs practiced in your home?
In our home, we prayed together often at meal, every day at mealtime, of course. We always ate every meal together. I grew up on the farm, so in a rural family, you just arranged your schedules that way. So we prayed together before and meals all the time. Morning prayer and prayed the morning offering together, which was really something special. Our evening prayers were private. You know, our night prayers that we said among our for ourselves, we didn't do those in common. But during Lent, during Advent, we pray the rosary together, follow the stations of the cross, read from the Bible. So we did that specifically during Advent and Lent, and sometimes May, because May is the month dedicated to the Blessed Mother. And so we pray the rosary together on the evenings in May. And so it was those three times of the year specifically when we would pray formally together.
Uh-huh. What about name days?
We did not have that tradition, and I think since I'm already once removed, another generation removed, the only thing we did for name days was, I remember that my father's, whose name was Adam, would get a gift from his dad on December 24th, because we grew up knowing or hearing that it was a custom in a German custom to sell that that Adams, the name day for Adam, was on December 24th. Now I've heard that from other sisters here too in this community, but I had not heard it formally from people who are not of German background. Anyway, that the feast of Saint Adam or Adam would be December 24th because of its connection to Christmas and the whole light coming into the world and the birth, rebirth of civilization, you know, I mean, of Christianity.
Yeah.
So Grandpa would bring Dad a gift on New Year's, I mean, on Christmas Eve. But other than that, we had no, in our particular family, we had no name day custom.
And I think it's gradually, gotten less through the years.
Mm-hmm. However, in our religious community here, we celebrate name days as much as birthdays, and in fact, more, even more.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a German custom from the native Germans to celebrate name days very much. In fact, even more so than birthdays.
Mm-hmm.
But at home, we did, I know we did all know our name day. We knew what they are say our patron saint was,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't do anything on those days.
Yeah. So were the German traditions that practiced in your family, was it talked about? The German-Russian?
Not really.
No.
See, because my mother was German-Hungarian descent, and my father German-Russian, and so we spoke, and my generation spoke only English, and I know we would ask Mom sometimes, Mom, how do you say this, and this word, a certain word, and say it in German, and then we'd ask Dad, say it in German, and they would have two different dialects, and so we just all said, oh, well, I guess they don't really communicate with each other, so that, we kind of dropped it, so we really did not talk at all about our German-Russian heritage. Because we knew that they were a little different. And
yeah, there wasn't that community in that area, was there?
Right, right.
Yeah. So are you familiar with the anti-garb legislation that happened in the 1940s, or you were too?
No, I wasn't even,
you
I
wasn't
even
born.
No. No, until the mid-50s. So I really have no experience with that at all.
So what was it like in your growing up years on the farm?
It was fun to have a large family. We got along very well. We're to this day a very close family. A number of the brothers and sisters were living out of state, but all have moved back since, except one family is in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But the others have all moved back so that we could be closer together. So now, and most of them are in Western North Dakota. We were a very close family. We spent a lot of time together. Our recreation mostly was together every Sunday afternoon from March through October. Practically every Sunday, we would take a drive to the pasture to check the cattle. And we'd all get on the back of the pickup. One kid would get in front with Dad, and the rest of us, Mom, and the rest of us would get on the back, and we'd sing and just have fun. Those were really family community times, and we would have lots of fun on the back of the pickup and drive, you know, 2 or 3 hours, just drive out there, have fun, and check the cattle, and come back. And,
yeah. So you did some singing, huh? Were you in a musical family?
Not formally.
No?
Not formally, but just singing the fun old Red River Valley and those kinds of things. Home on the Range, that was a favorite of my dad's.
As you were driving on the range.
Yes, yes, right. So the pastoral life, you know, was a very, very important to us.
Yeah. Did you have to work pretty hard?
Well, we did our share of work. We milked cows, so we had to, some of us did morning chores and some of us did evening chores, and my mother had a big garden. I was the baker and cook during the summers because my oldest sister, the oldest one in the family, is a girl, but she loved to be outside, and so she did all the raking and mowing until the boys got big enough, and then there were 5 boys in a row in our family, and so then, but she still went out, Kathy and all the boys were out in the fields, and Mom was in her garden, so I was the one who did most of the cooking and baking
Did you do a lot of canning and all that too, preserving?
My mother did all the canning and preserving, yes, but she did can and freeze vegetables and fruits and berries and rhubarb.
Remember picking berries?
Yes, yes. We had choke cherry trees on the west side of the house, of the yard, and several patches out in the pasture. Yeah. Juneberries, bullberries, or what do they say, buffalo berries, I think. Yeah. We call them bullberries.
Did you really do something with those bullberries?
Yes. Oh, they make the absolute best jam. Or jelly. Bullberry jelly.
Mm-hmm. And you waited until late fall when they were more,
yes.
I mean, they were very tart.
Yes.
Even then, I think, but when they were,
yes,
after a frost.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Dad said, never before August 15th. You never pick those before August 15th. And now, because I suppose, you know, it wouldn't freeze before then, but once it froze, then they were,
yeah,
easier to get.
Yeah, they weren't so easy to pick, were they?
No, they weren't.
They were prickly, yeah.
So we didn't can quarts and quarts of that, but just enough to get a little taste for Dad, because he loved the jelly and jam.
Yeah, and juneberries, wasn't that a treat?
Mm-hmm.
And not,
yes,
every year produced juneberries.
Right, right.
What'd you make with juneberries?
Well, we couldn't preserve them, of course, because they wouldn't last that long, but my mother would make a custard pie, a juneberry custard pie, that was, to this day, makes your mouth water.
It does, and then mm-hmm. even juneberry kuchen.
Oh, yes.
If you freeze the juneberries, you can make them.
That's right, that's right. Or else put them in ice cream. My dad loved ice cream, and so you just throw some, even frozen ones, into the ice cream after you dish it up, and just have a little topping.
We're not going to get that now, are we?
No,
I don't know. What was your school experience like? Did you went to a town school?
Yes.
Washer?
Right. Went to St. Lawrence Grade School for the first 4 years through fourth grade. And then it was the time when the sisters were leaving, pulling out of the schools,
oh,
and going into other apostolates, about 65, 66. And there were fewer sisters, plus there were more kids in our family. And we couldn't afford the tuition even anymore for all, so many of us. And so by the fifth grade, I had to go, we went over to the public school. And then I think when I was in sixth grade, that school closed. It had closed just because of lower enrollment and because of the whole fact that the sisters leaving it. My dad drove the bus for quite a number of years when I was in grade school. And in the early days, for the fact that if he drove the bus, then he could pick up us kids and take us to the Catholic school, even though he drove the bus for the public school.
Oh,
so that we would have that transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in first grade, my older sister and I stayed with Grandma and Grandpa in town so that we could go to the Catholic school because we had no bus.
Mm-hmm.
So we would stay with Grandma and Grandpa from Monday morning through until 4 o'clock on Friday.
Mm-hmm. How far were you from town?
13 miles. But bad roads. Mm-hmm. Muddy roads, and we live on the edge of a county, so sometimes it was the last one to be plowed out or kept up,
yeah,
or something. Just,
yeah. Were there kids, would you know if there were kids of other nationalities in your school?
Yeah,
I suppose by that age there were.
They were mostly German.
I think so.
As German Russian, as far as I know. There were some German Lutherans in the public school.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri Synod, I think it was, Lutherans in our school. And a congregation, United Church of Christ, and American Lutheran. So, but I think most of those were at least partially German background.
Yeah.
Fredericks and a lot of Hansons. There were a lot of, come to think of it, there were a good number of Hansons and Johnsons and things like that.
Scandinavians down there too.
Mm-hmm.
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 Mm-hmm. What did baptism and confirmation mean in your family then?
That was always a very important time, you know, signal in one's life. And I don't know you know, we weren't too aware of it as children. We just knew that it was very important that they be baptized, and it wasn't very long. I mean, you didn't hesitate. You just did it as soon, you know, as soon as Mom came home from the hospital, and the next Sunday was baptism, you know. Mm-hmm. And confirmation, I remember, was very important. I myself was confirmed in third grade, which is not the tradition now. Now they are at least 15 or 16 before they're confirmed. But I know I was confirmed in the fourth grade, because I remember the play that our teacher wrote about the gifts of the Holy Spirit and all, so that we could get it all in our mind. Mm-hmm. And as a teaching, and then we presented that play to our parents. It was a very big day. I was confirmed in May. It was very muddy. These are my recollections of it.
Yeah.
It was very muddy. And everyone else was disappointed because they could not go. The only ones who could go to my confirmation were my parents and myself, because we had to go in and pick up. And so the rest had to stay home. But otherwise, you know, had we been able to go in the car, everybody would have been there.
And you probably would have had a big dinner at the house.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of relatives close by, too?
We had one set of cousins in Flasher, and then my grandparents lived in Flasher. But we had about five or six sets of cousins on my dad's side in Bismarck and Mandan. And every year, they would, in the summers, they would often come out, different ones, and sometimes we'd have everybody together for a family picnic. Mm-hmm. And my mother to this day is very adamant about having family picnics in the summer. And now we don't call them reunions, but whoever can come, comes. But this is a day when all the A.M. Schaefers are getting together. And this is the day then when all the Adam, A.M. would be our family, but M.J. is my grandpa's family, so this is the M.J. Schaefers are getting together this Sunday, and the A.M. Schaefers are getting together this Sunday, you know.
So a strong sense of family.
Yes, that's
neat. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with wrought iron crosses? Was that something in that area?
I really couldn't say, although I know that we visited the cemeteries, and I know that there are some, but I really don't know too much about them. I don't even know if they have them on the graves of my grandparents. You know, I don't know much about that.
Yeah. Okay. But who are the keepers of your family treasures? Do you have some old things in the family?
Mm-hmm. We have some things right now that are stored in my parents' house, stored in their basement from Grandpa Schaefer when he died in 89, and he was 93 years old. And since my father lives in the farm home that all of his brothers and sisters grew up in, that's they would be the keepers of the family treasures. And I remember when my grandpa died, the word was spread to me that, or given, told me by someone, now you're going to be the one who's in charge, because you're a librarian, you can put everything in order. Well, that never really materialized, because we didn't know what we were going to do with the things. And but he has daughters, grandpa's daughters live in Bismarck, three of them, and two sons up there. And so I'm not really sure who's got all the photo albums and things, but I know some of the other things my parents have.
Hmm. Are you related to the governor by any chance?
No, our names are spelled exactly the same, but there's no relationship.
Uh-huh.
No.
There's a lot of Schaefers.
Uh-huh. Many Schaefers, but not many who spell theirs like we do.
More with two F's.
Right, or A-E. Uh-huh. But ours is just plain S-C-H-A-F-E-R.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I know I did look on an old map of North Dakota that we had in our house. When Medora became popular, I suppose it would be back in the 60s sometime, when I was becoming map conscious and things like that, I noticed on a map a little town out in western North Dakota called Schaefer. And it was always my desire to find out about that. Then when I read about Harold Schaefer and restoring Medora and all of that, I thought there must be some connection, because it's very close to Medora. Well, it may have been one of those early post offices that was on land on the farmstead of a Schaefer, and that's where I got the name Schaefer. And it probably was the family of Harold Schaefer and the governor.
Yeah.
But we have no relationship to them.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to Medora?
Oh, yes. I've been there a couple times.
So. Yes.
Yeah. It's fun.
It sure is. The music was so good, you know. And do you remember going to wedding dances when you were at?
Oh, yes. Yes.
At home, yeah.
Grew up learning to dance at the wedding dances.
Yes.
Now, my father is somewhat shy and retiring. I wouldn't call him shy, but he just doesn't like crowds. And he'd much rather be at home in on his little domain, on his little land. And my mother, however, is just the opposite. She would like to, you know, to go more often. But many of us inherited that tendency of my father's, you know, to kind of just like to stay on the land. And if we get out, that's okay. So we didn't go to many wedding dances that were not our relatives. You know, for all of our relatives, we were there, but didn't go to many, that I remember, many others in the community. And consequently, I learned to dance with my uncles, you know, at these wedding dances. So.
And what did you dance?
Oh, the butterfly, the two-step. What else? I don't really dance the polka very well. And waltzes, of course.
Yeah.
Waltzes, of course. But yeah. I love to watch. Schottisch, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Love to watch him dance the polka, but.
Yeah, that's very tiring. What kind of foods were served at weddings then?
Well, I remember that at the reception we were met with a bottle of that little, was it red eye or was it?
Yes, Hochzeit Schnaps.
Yeah.
But it was red eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whiskey, burnt sugar, Grandpa would say. Oh, this is just burnt sugar.
And we did a little alcohol.
Yeah, and we didn't know what it was as children, but we were very happy that they included us and that we got a little drink. That was the only time we ever had any alcohol in our house. We just didn't have anything in our house, but mm-hmm. we saw it at the wedding.
Yeah.
And other than that, I don't remember any specific foods. I know that Grandma did make kuchen, but not that this was the famous wedding kuchen, although it may have, but I was not aware of it, you know, when mm-hmm. we were growing up.
And they always had such big, like midnight lunches, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember that, always having kuchen.
Yeah.
And probably sausage.
Now see, I don't remember that we were there long enough to be at a midnight lunch, see,
mm-hmm.
because the cows probably had to be milked. And so we had to get home and do it, you know,
yeah.
so we would,
or at least get some rest before you went.
Yeah,
get it,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So what about German foods in the home? Did your mother cook anything ethnic?
Yes, they did make homemade sausage when I was very young. But it's very interesting that how one's life is influenced by the preferences of a parent. Now my dad hated to butcher, hated that job of butchering, and so they would put it off until the very end, you know, until it was absolutely no meat in the house. And then he'd butcher again, and so, but he hated to make sausage, so we didn't always make sausage.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we had someone make it for us in town,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really remember that, but I can only remember two or three times that we made sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad didn't like dough dishes made out of dough,
yeah.
or he just simply couldn't eat them, you know, couldn't digest them or whatever, and so my mother brought all these recipes from home when she was married, you know, because we, in her recipe box, she has all these recipes that she wrote out
mm-hmm.
to make all these dough dishes that her mother made that are just wonderful. And us kids love them. But my dad couldn't eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And so she rarely made them
mm-hmm.
unless my dad was gone. He was a real mail carrier
mm-hmm.
Substitute when we were growing up, as well as an electrician. And he would sometimes be gone on troubleshooting calls for the neighbors. And if he was gone over a noon meal, like in the summertime or something, or on Saturday when we were home from school, then we would talk Mom into making one of those dough dishes.
Like what?
Well, Schupnudeln, mm-hmm. we made. That was our favorite that Mom made. And we really didn't have, people talk about casement, but, and we didn't have that because Dad didn't like it. And so really the only thing that I can think of is those schupnudler. Also, or else when you make set bread, set dough to bake bread, and then Mom would take off the top, pinch off a little bit of the raw dough and cut it off, and then fry it, I think, or boil it.
Deep fry.
Oh, no, not deep fry. That dough, no. She would steam it. She would have potatoes and onions steaming, and then she would drop these little balls on top of, to cover the potatoes, and then it would be, that would steam it in a big black kettle, a big black frying pan.
Like dumplings.
Yeah, dumplings. But they're made out of that raw dough.
Oh, I know. And not everyone makes them like that. I did another interview, and the lady even gave me the recipe for her dumplings, but they're way different. I like to make some dough, too.
Mm-hmm.
And usually on wash day. I don't know why, on the busiest day, that she'd have to make a big kettle of maybe pork chops and then lots of potatoes and onions, and then she'd also make bread and cut off that dough, maybe roll it like this, or round.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, lay them on top, and that was dumplings. You dunk it a little gravy.
Yeah. And then you couldn't lift the cover on the kettle because then it would fall.
Yes.
So we grew up not liking those things you make out of biscuit, you know? Like dumplings that you make out of biscuit. Bread dough, bread biscuits or whatever you call them.
Uh-huh.
Because after you ate those bread dough dumplings, what else? And you can't eat anything else.
Yes. Good. Nothing takes its place. Yeah. How about Fleischkäse?
We did not make that in our family either, and I think it was because my dad didn't like it. We didn't, but I recollect we did not make sauerkraut, you know, which was really rare, but I don't ever have a recollection of them making it. I know once in a while they would make, we would talk Mom or Dad into making some rhubarb wine.
Yeah.
But I can maybe say 2 or 3 years we made that, and then we would just have a little sip of that.
Yeah.
But other than that, I can't remember other things that we made.
Okay. Were there barn dances in your day?
No.
No. That was earlier.
Earlier. Yeah.
What are some of the games that you played as a child? There were so many of you in the family.
Oh, we played Red Rover. And I heard someone mention anti-over. Dad taught us that, I remember. There was a little game called Mip.
Well, it's just what Sister
Alverna?
The one that Mike introduced.
Sister Barbara Marie.
Barbara Marie,
Mip. We played that, especially when my uncles and my dad's brothers would come. They would whittle the sticks and whittle the little Mip that you played with. And somebody would say, let's go and start a game of Mip. And then they would play. So they taught us that when they would come home for these family picnics. But I can't say that us kids really sat down and, you know, played that by ourselves. We played baseball.
Yeah. How do you spell Mip? Do you know?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Probably just how it's
Probably just N-I-P. Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anybody in that community that did Brauta or folk medicine?
No, don't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents use any expressions in any other language?
Oh, once in a while they had a few little German things that they said in German, but we didn't know what they meant, and it wasn't very much, no.
Mm-hmm. Did your family watch Lawrence Welk?
Yes. Mm-hmm. For some years, we couldn't always get it on the radio, television station. And so it wasn't a common thing in our house. Although when it was on, when we could get it, after a while, for a few, maybe 2 or 3 years, we could get it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did every afternoon. I mean, often at noon, after dinner would be ready, and we'd be waiting for Mom to come, for Dad to come in the field, from the fields. Mike Dosh played organ music, polkas and waltzes, over KFYR in Bismarck.
Mm-hmm.
my dash hour. Did you remember that?
I remember. Uh-huh.
And mom would pick us kids up and dance around the kitchen with them.
Oh.
While we were passing the time waiting for dad to come home. When I was very little, I remember that.
Uh-huh. And I can't help but think how that instilled the rhythm in these young children. And when you're older, if you didn't have that experience, it's just harder to learn.
Right.
I really believe that. So how is your family history and culture being passed on to the next generation?
Well, I guess it's hard to answer that. However, my grandfather told us these wonderful stories, and not such a variety of them, but every time we would see Grandpa in his later years, he would tell us the same stories. And so I remember when I left for the convent, I left in June and then came back during December, as I had mentioned before, as a postulant. During that home visit there, in December of 1980, I said to Grandpa, when I saw him, "Grandpa, will you please tell me all the details? Because I don't know if anybody else is going to write it down, but I want to know."
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me this, and I have it dated here, 12/15/1980, and it was actually about three times as many little slips of scratch paper that I wrote down all these notes on,
mm-hmm.
From stories that he said. I said, "Grandpa, now you always talk about all the different jobs you had after you retired from farming. You know, what were they?" So he made me a list of all the things that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this wonderful story about when he was in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Which war? First World War.
Mm-hmm.
He came over from... Do you want to hear all this about when he came over and all this?
When he came, oh yeah.
My grandpa.
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Michael J. Schaefer came over from the colony of Speyer. In 1908, they emigrated. He was born in 1896, so he would have been 100 in February.
Yeah.
And he died in 1989. But when he was within 1918, he was inducted into the war in February of 1918. And he was a blacksmith and in charge of about 104 men. He said they were in an infantry supply division where they would do the horseshoeing, the shoeing of the horses for the army, for the infantry. And he was in charge, he was a foreman in that blacksmith shop. So there were 52 forges and two men working at each forge, and he was in charge of them. Well, when the influenza came, it swept through the camp too, and he felt it coming to him one day that he needed to go to the doctor. So he took his papers, his registration papers and his identification, and he had them in his hand, and he was standing in line to see the doctor. And while he was there, he collapsed in line.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was such a large number of people who needed attention, and someone saw him, that he had fallen. They took his paper out of his hands, pinned him to the inside of his shirt, and took him to the warehouse where they stored the dead, because they said there are others who need more attention than he does. He woke up after 3 days, is how I remember he told me the story. Now, that's what we heard as children, but when he gave me all this information, for sure, he said he woke up after a day and a night. He moaned in there for a day and a night, and he thought, these were his words, "By God, I'm too young to die. I got lots to do in my life yet." So he caught the attention of someone who was bringing in more dead bodies, and got their attention. Attendant and told him that, you know, he wasn't ready to for this place. By that time, he had double pneumonia, was checked into the hospital, and spent 31 days in the hospital. And in fact, he was so close to death that the chaplain was asked to come and give him the last rites of the church, the sacrament of anointing, we call it today. But after 31 days, he was better. And they didn't actually discharge him, but they made him an orderly, gave him a first aid course,
where he was taking temperatures and respiration and so forth. He said he was finally discharged from the hospital on Armistice Day, mm-hmm. on November 11, 1918. Mm-hmm. And so then he went back to his infantry company and later spoke to the same chaplain who had given him the last rites. He was discharged from the Army in February of 1919.
Where was he at?
He was at Camp Custer in Battle Creek, Michigan. Oh. That's where he was working in the Army.
Oh, that's a very interesting story.
Interesting. We heard it hundreds of times as children. You know, that was Grandpa's story. Yeah. He has another story that he told about when they came over from Germany, or from Russia. He came over, they came over in 1908, so he was about 12 years old, or 14, he was 14 years old. There were 8 people in their party, his parents, John Louis Schaefer, and his mother Magdalene, and then his older sister Mary Eva, and then there were these 3 boys, Michael John was my grandpa, Louis John, and Jerome John. Did you ever hear about that custom of naming all the sons in the family, giving them the middle name of the father?
No, even my family, the males didn't even have middle names.
Oh, no. So now this I find in all of the records that Grandpa gave me. He was Michael John, and then his brother was Louis John and Jerome John. And they all received John as their middle name because their dad's name was John. Mm-hmm. Now in my dad's generation, the same thing happened to some of the boys. My grandpa was Michael, and so my dad is Adam Michael. Mm-hmm. And there's Otto Michael and Leo Michael and the youngest son, James Michael. But about 3 boys in between there did not receive Michael. So it was already starting to change mm-hmm. in the late 20s and 30s.